Menards has everything you need for your next big project. Update the lighting in your garage or workspace with our great selection of utility lighting options. The High Bay Light features a 5,000 Kelvin color temperature, wet rated, and a long life over 100,000 hours, so you'll have light for whenever you need. Get the 11 inches High Bay Light for $89.99. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals.
Save big money at Menards.
High Five Casino lets you play your favorite slot and live table games, like blackjack, with the chance to redeem for real cash prizes. High Five Casino has a giant selection of over 1,200 games, including hundreds of exclusive games only found on High Five Casino. It's always free to play, and free coins are given out every 4 hours. Ready to have your own High Five moment? Visit HighFiveCasino.com. That's high, the number 5, casino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating. We really appreciate it. Coming up on this week's program, we're going to be speaking about a giant iceberg, a mega iceberg, 100 miles wide, that broke off from the Antarctic shelf and drifted into the open sea. What happens next? If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter at Newstalk Science, and we get to all of your comments at the end of the podcast. First up, it's time to look back at the week's science news, though. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. You're both very welcome. Our first story, Shane, has to do with space photosynthesis. What on earth is that?
This is unconfirmed work from Chinese astronauts that they're making oxygen and quote unquote rocket fuel in an
artificial... God, you sound very skeptical before we even got out of the gates, Shane.
Quote my job unquote to be skeptical.
Rocket fuel, right? Okay, go on.
Yeah, so they've made rocket fuel and oxygen, and they've done it kind of in a reaction that's sort of mimicking the photosynthesis reaction that we're familiar with here on Earth. Of course, photosynthesis is where you take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, you add it with water. In the presence of sunlight, you can produce glucose, which is food for plants. And it's the fundamental biological equation, I suspect, says he, that's a physicist. And it's remarkable when you think about it. I think photosynthesis must be one of the most remarkable things, that you can use sunlight, a gas, and from that, with a little bit of water, you can make food.
But we can't. Plants can.
Plants can, yeah. Plants are better than us. So the astronauts in the Chinese space station, which is called the Heavenly Palace, it's in a low Earth orbit since 2022. They're saying that they've been able to combine carbon dioxide with water using a semiconductor catalyst to produce oxygen, which is helpful if you're in an atmosphere without it up there, and ethylene. Yeah, ethylene is a fuel, right? So it's sort of like acetylene, but slightly different from a chemical point of view. Acetylene being what's in a blowtorch. So they're able to make this rocket fuel and oxygen. And I think this is incredible if it's true. The reason that I'm hesitant is this is not published.
So
right?
Hesitant.
So like Ruth and I would always look to the source papers for the stories that we talk about on this news round. So these things would have been peer reviewed. I'm not saying it's untrue. It's just that it's a claim, and we have to take their word for it, as opposed to looking at the raw data and looking at the science behind these claims. But if it is true, it is remarkable because it's very difficult to make oxygen. Typically, what we have to do is we have to split water in a process called electrolysis.
Yeah.
And so you take H2O and you turn it into hydrogen and oxygen. And that takes a lot of electricity to do that. Mm. So if they have...
Because oxygen loves other elements. It's a very sticky element, right?
It is an aggressive element. It likes to strip away things from other elements. It's greedy.
Yeah.
And it's like a disruptive member of a family. It'll come in and it'll disorganize everything to suit itself.
In terms of the technical achievement, is that why is this happening in space? Why is that? I mean, why is that an element? Wouldn't it be just as impressive if they did this back on Earth? Why is space even part of this? Do they need to be in space to do it?
No, they don't. But what's interesting here is that they're doing it in space to demonstrate that if they were to build, say, a moon base where they'd need a reliable and continuous source of oxygen, fuel, and perhaps food, that they now have the beginnings of a chemistry that might offer them solutions. And they're saying if you change the catalyst, you could make methane, which is the fuel, or you can make formic acid, which is a precursor to sugar, which would be the basic ingredient for carbohydrates, which we'd eat. So if it's true, that's pretty incredible. So let's see if they publish it.
Right. Okay. If it's true, amazing work. Thank you very much, Shane. Ruth, on slightly more solid ground, I feel our second story has to do with epigenetics. So maybe not actually.
It was published in Molecular Psychiatry, which is a reputable journal. So that's a very good start to the story. And it's from a project that's been going on in Finland for about 15 years called the Finn Brain Project. And that is a cohort study looking at over 4,000 families in Finland and looking at environmental and genetic factors influencing the development of a child. And as I said, they're looking at family cohorts. And this in this work, what they did was they identified 55 middle-aged men in the cohort. And they were able to control for a lot of lifestyle factors like smoking, weight, stress, those kind of things.
Watching too much TV.
They were able to divide those men into two groups. And half of the men had experienced quite significant childhood trauma. And then they went and looked.
Like what?
They used a very specific score, a criteria that is used to measure childhood trauma. So they didn't go into the details of what that trauma was, but it's a well-established mechanism to look for significant childhood trauma.
Right.
And then they went in and they looked, as you said, at the epigenetics of the sperm cells in those men. And the epigenetics are the changes that can happen on top of our DNA. So if you imagine the DNA that you and I have in our cells is a bit like the script of a play. Imagine a Shakespeare play. It's been written that way. But then different directors come along and they write notes around the margins and they give different instructions to the actors on the stage. Yeah. And that's exactly what happens with our DNA. So things like our environment, things like smoking and other factors can put different markers on our DNA to change how the different genes are expressed. And one of the most common things we look at is methylation, which is where methyl groups are added onto our genes and changes the way they are expressed.
And they can turn up volume or turn down volume of certain genes.
Exactly, turning up volume, turning up and down activity. And what they found was there was three specific genetic regions where they found lower levels of DNA methylation. And they also found that the level of small non-coding RNAs was different in the men that had experienced the trauma versus those that hadn't.
Is that a very high P factor? Like, are we talking very significant? Because it's a small enough number of people, right?
It is a small enough number of people, but they are. This is apparently the largest sort of study of its type that's been reported so far. And I think what was interesting, though, is when they looked at where the genes that were impacted by these epigenetic changes are specific, they play a crucial role in early brain development. So what they plan to do now is to go on, because these are cohorts in families. So they are going to go on to see if they can detect any impact in the brain development of these men's children. But that is certainly the hypothesis that they are testing. And it's one that's been around for a long time. And we do have some evidence to show that things like if you have mice that are exposed to very early life stress in lab conditions, that there are changes in their sperm, which seems to impact on the behavior and the ability of their offspring to manage stress.
The Scandis love this epigenetic things, don't they? Wasn't there a Swedish study? It was like famine. It was like
I thought it was a Dutch study, actually. But there's been a number of studies which have looked at actually intergenerational trauma. And I think that is much less confirmed. This idea actually that there was a study done actually on people who had ancestors that were in the Holocaust to see if you could still find the signature of that trauma in their genes. And I don't think we have firm evidence on that. But this one isn't that surprising. It's the idea that there are some changes that happen to you which impact the cells in your body. And obviously some of those are the gametes, the cells that are being made to produce your offspring. So I think from that point of view, it's probably not as surprising or not as much of a stretch as some of the other studies on epigenetics.
Very good. Shane, our third story is a really interesting one. It has to do with some of the largest mountains on Earth, but they're not overground and they're not underwater.
Yeah, they're underground mountains.
What?
Which, yeah, how does that work? So this is a story that was published in Nature very recently, and they claim to have discovered two mountains under the Earth's surface, both of whom are 100 times taller than Mount Everest. So for reference, Mount Everest is almost 9 kilometers in height, and these are...
God,
they
shut
say,
up.
It has, hasn't it?
Last time I looked, I thought it was about 5,000 kilometers. Maybe that's me.
It's possibly still growing. And that's interesting for this story
it's
because...
shrinking, actually.
Oh, well, there we go.
It is shrinking, but very, very slowly. Yes, that's correct, yeah.
Right. So
Shane's like, just let me tell the story. Go on.
So these mountains are between the core of the Earth and the mantle. And they basically exist, they're in a graveyard of subducted tectonic plates, right? What does that mean? So the surface of the Earth has all these plates on them, and they actually kind of float above molten or semi-permanent or solid rock below. And every so often, and in certain places, one will go under the other, right? And they're kind of, we think of places where we have earthquakes, like in California,
subduction,
for example.
Yeah.
Exactly. So what this story or this piece is suggesting is that they maybe are coalescing or gathering together in certain parts under the Earth and forming massive discontinuities that the researchers are calling mountains under the ground.
I see a very skeptical looking face on Ruth. We're very skeptical this week.
Yeah, I agree with Ruth. It's ridiculous to call these mountains, but it's because they're rocks surrounded by rock, right? But nevertheless, they're large structures that are homogeneous and are different to the area around them. And how they know this is perhaps the most incredible thing. So when earthquakes happen, scientists are able to follow the waves as they go from one side of the Earth through the middle and out the other. And so-called P waves, which are remarkable. And they're able to tell basically how the wave changes. And based on those changes, they can tell whether the wave is moving from kind of one material to another. The analogy I'd give here is, you know, sound going through air and then going through water. It behaves differently. So it's exactly the same, except the wavelengths here are enormous when they're associated with earthquakes. And that means they're able to travel through dense materials like rock all the way through to the other side of the Earth. So they're able to tell. That's how we know we have cores.
I mean, this is hard science. I mean, literally, it's rock. And yet you're still doubting it, Shane. So I don't know. Maybe it's just...
No, I'm not doubting it. I'm not doubting it at all. It's just I think the terminology for mountain is...
Yeah, I think that was probably... someone had a wise idea of putting that into a press release and we fell for it.
They should have gone to your public engagement workshops. I'm sure they would have figured out a different way to say it. Yeah.
All right. I probably would have said underground mountains, actually. Our final story, Ruth, has to do with food tolerance, which is definitely a thing.
Well, it's about how we tolerate food and not, we don't have an immune reaction to every bite of food that we put into our mouths, which is kind of amazing when you think about how incredibly well primed our immune system is to deal with invaders. But yet, as we try loads of different foods throughout our life, our body knows that it's food. And for the most part, it doesn't attack it. And the reason that happens is that when we are young, usually when we're babies, as we try different kinds of food, our immune system has a look at that food as it goes into our body, and cells called dendritic cells, as the proteins of the food get broken down, they essentially take little bits of protein and they present them to antigen-presenting cells, which are special cells in our gut. And basically, the antigen-presenting cell, if there's no cause for alarm, so there's no inflammation, there's no negative thing happening in the body, it's not being damaged, they will send a signal to T cells, regulatory T cells, sort of instructing them to stand down. Everything is fine. A protein that looks like this is not a cause for alarm.
Right.
And as we experience different foods, actually breast milk's a great way for babies to get lots of different types of proteins into their body. For the most part, we learn to tolerate food. But this is new research that was just published in Science from Rockefeller University. And they've sort of taken this understanding to another level. They've identified the exact antigen-presenting cells that are responsible for doing this in the gut. And they used a really innovative technique, which is an acronym, which is LIPSTIC. But LIPSTIC basically is a labeling system for individual cells, where one cell is engineered to express an enzyme called sortase. And then if that cell comes into contact with another single cell, it transfers a little chemical tag to that other cell.
Right.
So we can see exactly what's going on at a cellular level. So they obviously tagged the antigen-presenting cells, and then they were able to see which antigen-presenting cells were tagging the T regulatory cells. And this is very interesting because actually when this doesn't work for some people, this is where we get food allergy. When instead of being seen as safe, food is seen as unsafe and mounts sometimes a fatal immune response. Even though this is building on a lot of what we know, I mean, tolerance has been taught in textbooks for decades, we're now really getting down to the specific cells that are allowing us to eat a meal without dying.
Which is amazing that they're sort of molecule to cell being able to map this pathway, because you can absolutely see how therapeutic targets for food intolerances and allergies and so on may follow when we understand this a bit more. Really interesting stuff. Dr. Ruth Freeman and our skeptic Shane Bergen, thank you very much for joining us. On the way, mega icebergs. There, I committed. Stay with us. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McCrae. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us at scienceatnewstalk.com. My next guest has been looking at the unusual ways that mega icebergs impact the ocean and marine life that's around them, even sending underwater drones to investigate. Well, he's Professor Geraint Tarling, and he's from the British Antarctic Survey. Welcome to the program, Geraint. When we talk about these icebergs, exactly how big are we talking about? What are you interested in?
Well, to be an iceberg, you need to be at least 500 meters squared. So anything below that is either a bergy bit or
A bergy bit?
Yeah, a bergy bit. That's what we call small things that are actually not quite icebergs. So 5 meters squared, that's roughly going to be about 5 meters above sea level. But as we know with icebergs, 7/8 of them are actually below the water. So that's something like that would be about 30 meters thick. But the one we're talking about, we got really interested in, was the one that was called A68, and that actually broke away from the Larsen C ice shelf back in 2017. And that one was 158 kilometers long and 5,700 kilometers squared. So that's half the size of Northern Ireland or the size of Greater London. So that was absolutely super massive. And that was 30 meters above sea level and 200 meters below sea level. So a really deep, high iceberg.
That is an enormous iceberg. Can you tell me how much notice you get when something like that happens? I mean, when you see the calving of an iceberg that size, presumably you know about it well before it actually happens because it's so big.
Yeah, well, we see the cracks happening. We have continuously monitoring satellites, looking at all these regions where icebergs could carve off from. So the crack was actually noticed a long time before it actually went all the way through and made that part of the ice shelf into an iceberg. And it was quite a major event when it did happen. The world's attention really was on it from the science side anyway, because we wanted to know what was underneath that iceberg. It had been many thousands of years since that part of the seabed had been exposed. And so the initial attention on this iceberg was actually, well, can we get in there to actually find this pristine bit of seabed to see what would happen if it was actually covered in ice? So that was an expedition that almost happened straight away when we saw this crack happening.
And so this, just give me a bit of geography here. Whereabouts are we talking exactly, this iceberg?
Yeah, so the iceberg carved off a place called Larsen C. It's an ice shelf that, if you can imagine Antarctica, there's like a sticky out bit, which is the Antarctic Peninsula. So to the right-hand side of that peninsula, you have lots of ice shelves. A lot of them got different names. On one of those ice shelves, we even have one of our stations called Halley, but it's a little bit to the west of there. And there was something just about halfway up the Antarctic Peninsula, this bit of ice actually cracked off and went into a part of the Southern Ocean that we call the Weddell Sea. And it hung around there for quite a long time, actually almost 3 years, but it just didn't go very far because that part of the Weddell Sea is full of sea ice. It's seasonal, but most of it stays around for most of the year. So it just didn't allow the iceberg to travel very far.
Oh, right. I sort of imagined that it would just go off like it does in the movies, or just head off into the sunset, but it sort of stuck around. So when something like that happens, I mean, to be there exactly when it happens, that might be a tricky thing to coordinate. Were there people there to record the event when it actually separated entirely? And what is it like being there or recording something like that?
Yeah, for when the actual part of that iceberg carved off, we knew it was going to happen. It was inevitable. And so there was some notice to try and mobilize an expedition to get there. Unfortunately, that one was foiled because there was too much of this sea ice around for them to actually get into this area. So they had to wait another year. And then by then, the opportunity to be lost because things were starting to colonize that area again. It wasn't pristine. And so the story went a little bit cold after that, actually, quite literally. We just didn't do very much. And we didn't know what was going to happen next. But just at the end of that 3 years where it was circulating around the Weddell Sea, it just came out into the open ocean a bit. And that happens to a lot of icebergs. It happens so often that we actually call this area Iceberg Alley. So it spins out outside of the Antarctic Peninsula, goes into the open ocean, and goes into an enormous current called the Antarctic Circumpolar Current. And from there, it heads east, and then east and north. And in its path, quite often for many of these icebergs, is South Georgia, which is an area that we have a lot of interest. We do a lot of research around there. So that's when we started to pay attention that something might be heading towards South Georgia that was particularly enormous.
If it reaches like the shores of, for example, if it reaches the shores of Greenland or Ireland or any other particular country, does it then become part of that country if it's within the international waters? Like, what happens to a moving iceberg? Who owns it?
I've never been asked that question before. I don't think you should really pay that much attention to an iceberg because eventually it's going to melt. Unless it's actually in the Arctic or the Southern Ocean, you probably got about 6 months at most. So you might
really
lose territory for that length of time, but it's nothing permanent really. Yeah.
6 months? That amount of ice can melt that quickly?
I mean, this one actually melted even quicker than that. This huge area actually melted in about 3 months by the time we got to South Georgia. And we were really interested to see, well, actually, even in that 3 months, it's really important where it actually lands around South Georgia, if it lands at all. So we managed to actually go to our government and just say, well, actually, what can we actually do to try and mobilize something to go here and actually see what's going to happen next to this iceberg? Because there isn't that much done on icebergs because they're such ephemeral things. You can't really mobilize an oceanographic expedition, which almost takes years to plan, to say, we're going to study icebergs. So you might get there, there'd be nothing there. So you have to be quite opportunistic to actually say, well, we know this expedition's going. Can we just divert it for a few days to go to the iceberg and do some really unique science? And in this occasion, we were really lucky because there was an expedition just about to mobilize to go into a similar area. And we managed to put lots of more technology onto that ship to actually do some really incredible science around this particular iceberg.
Amazing. So you managed to get this short window in which to try and understand what happens when an iceberg of this size hits the open oceans. What did you find out about it and how did you study it?
Yeah, well, the technology is quite oceanographic in that what we do, we take lots of water samples, we put lots of probes from the ship that we got as close as we possibly could to the iceberg. But the other fantastic thing we managed to do with this one, we had some underwater drones. And so these things are called gliders. And you can program them to have a course. It'll come up to the surface of the ocean and then contact you and say, well, here I am. What's my next instructions? And so on. You put these things, under very treacherous conditions that you couldn't put a ship into. So this was a fantastic opportunity to use one of these and put it under the iceberg itself and then get some observations we'd never made before. So we really wanted to know in particular what happens when icebergs melt, because we know this thing was going to melt quite quickly. It was actually probably the world's first to actually get an iceberg just as it's about to melt enormously and see what happens next. What's going to happen to all this fresh water? And in that iceberg, by the time it got to South Georgia, there was 152 billion tons of fresh water all there, ready to melt. And we wanted to know what impact that was going to have.
Wow. So what did you learn about the iceberg from the drone itself? Because I'm wondering, would that drone go very deep? Would it actually go right underneath it? And if so, is there not a danger of losing it?
There's an incredible danger of losing it. Yeah, it's at 200 meters down. It would have to go to get underneath the iceberg. That's what it did. It's incredibly craggy. It's unknown. We don't know whether it was going to get caught in a sort of an underwater peak, if you can imagine that, or get lost in a cave or something. So it was a very risky operation, and we had to convince a lot of people to do that. What we really wanted to know was, where was this fresh water coming from? Where was the melt happening? Because that really matters with an iceberg. If it's a really deep melt, then that goes into a different part of the water column where, if you can imagine an ocean that actually is quite stratified, almost like an Irish coffee. You've got like a layer on the top, then you've got sort of the various layers underneath. These are all at different temperatures and salinities. And what an iceberg's doing is coming in and really disrupting these layers because it's pumping loads of fresh water, which is quite buoyant, deep down into the ocean. And when it's doing that, it does what we call mixing. It mixes the oceans and brings up lots of things that are deep down that shouldn't be in the surface. It's bringing them all up to the surface. And the consequences of that are really important when you think about the productivity of the oceans. What I mean by that is that right on the surface of the ocean, where there's lots of light, you get lots of algae, lots of phytoplankton, which are photosynthesizing. They need the light to photosynthesize. What they also need is they need nutrients. And that's what they lack in a lot of the ocean. They don't have these nutrients, which are really abundant deep down, but they're all used up in the surface. So one of the things we found was that all this fresh water deep down was bringing all these nutrients up to the surface and then creating a new burst of productivity right at the surface of the ocean.
Which on the surface of it sounds like a good thing, but any change in the oceans typically comes with a warning tag.
It does. I mean, the oceans are incredibly variable anyway. And a lot of the satellite work we'd done up until this point had shown that whenever an iceberg had gone into a region, there was almost like a snail's trail behind it of this green mass that you can spot from satellites, which is all the productivity, all this sort of phytoplankton that is sort of allowed to bloom in its wake because it's brought all these nutrients to the surface. And what we were finding with these underwater drones and also the ship around it was how this process was happening. But it's not a bad thing, actually. In some ways, you know, a lot of the science now is working out how much of the CO2 in the atmosphere, because with photosynthesis, you're pulling CO2 in, how much do the oceans compensate for the CO2 we're putting into the atmosphere? So a productivity like this primary productivity is actually pulling CO2 in from the atmosphere and into the ocean. So that's a good thing. And that's what we really want to try and quantify to work out how much of an impact icebergs like this are having in actually mitigating CO2 in the atmosphere.
I'm trying to work out the physics of the speed at which this iceberg melted, considering when it was attached, obviously it wasn't melting anywhere close to that. And is that just a matter of the warmth of the water into which it entered? Or are there other reasons why it stayed intact for millions of years while it was connected? And then as soon as it is let loose, it disappears so quickly.
Yeah, it's definitely to do with warming. So where it started, you know, the waters there are even below freezing. You know, some of them are -1 or so. And so that's not going to melt anything at all. And that around the peninsula, that's what you see the water temperature typically at. As soon as it goes north towards areas like South Georgia, or right at the northern tip of where the Southern Ocean extends to, the waters there are going to be about 3 or 4 degrees C, and that's actually going to have a big impact on the rate of melt. But the other thing that's happening is that the waters there are really stormy. And the other thing that it does to the iceberg is it starts to break it up. It flexes the iceberg. If you can imagine the dimensions of an iceberg, it's really long, it's really wide, but very thin in a relative sense. And it's almost like a credit card. It's almost, that's the dimensions of it. And if you start flexing that and you're not very flexible, you're going to start snapping. And then that increases your surface area on the outside and you're more exposed to these melting forces. So it's the two things combined, the temperature and also the ocean forces acting on the iceberg.
Obviously, there's melting from the warm water, but then there's also surface melting as well. Did you learn anything about the rate of melt, or is that something that you were interested in?
Yeah, we were getting most information on that actually from satellites, because there's a really fantastic satellites that can measure the height of things, even icebergs in the ocean. So we had a couple of scientists working on the satellite information, just showing how the height of the iceberg was decreasing over time. And they were estimating then the rate of surface melt. And they measured at their peak, it was about 1.5 billion tons a day was actually pouring off this iceberg into these waters around South Georgia. So that's many, many millions of Olympic-sized swimming pools pouring into this delicate ecosystem around South Georgia. So a huge perturbation.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, icebergs falling into the sea are quite iconic as a sort of emblem of climate change. What does this tell us about the rate of warming generally? And are we likely to see more icebergs of this immense size in the near future because of the rate of global warming?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. And we sort of tackle this question mostly by models. So actually carving of icebergs is a natural process. If you can imagine like pouring icing onto a sort of a domed cake, things just generally move to the outside. So that's like snow falling on Antarctica. So things get to the edge, they eventually peel off, and that's within natural process. But if you're warming things up, this whole process happens quicker. So you get more icebergs being delivered into the ocean at a higher rate of frequency. So we think it's going to happen more and more. And in fact, since A68, which actually reached its zenith around 2021, we've had about five or six other megabergs come into this area, maybe not as famous as this particular one. And we haven't been able to mobilize anywhere near as much as for this iceberg. But actually, these things are happening all the time, and we think they're going to increase. And so these perturbations and also the productivity, which is a good thing, is possibly going to increase into the future as a result of warming.
Right. I suppose, look, this is the world that we are finding ourselves in. It's important to understand what the implications are. Professor Geraint Tarling of the British Antarctic Survey, thanks so much for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
If you want to have a grasp of how big this thing is, you can have a look at our Twitter account and you'll see the A68A iceberg in all its full glory. On the way, how to print a human heart.
It's time to have your high five moment with High Five Casino, the top social casino where the action and real prizes never stop. Fun spins and big wins are right at your fingertips with over 1,000 games, including High Five Casino exclusives. High Five Casino is always free to play with free coins given out every 4 hours. Sign up today and get free welcome coins you can spin for a chance at cash prizes. Visit highfivecasino.com.
High Five Casino.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. Must be 21 years or older. Terms and conditions apply.